Now, Monitor brings you Meet the Press, the prize-winning interview program produced by Lawrence E. Spivak, with four of America's top news reporters ready for this spontaneous, unrehearsed conference. Here's the moderator of Meet the Press, Ned Brooks. Welcome once again to Meet the Press. This is Heart Month, and our guest today is internationally known heart specialist, Dr. Paul Dudley White of Boston. His name became known to millions throughout the world when he attended President Eisenhower following his heart attack in September of 1955. Later, he served as the head of a board of six doctors who pronounced the president sufficiently recovered to run for a second term. Dr. White is the honorary co-chairman with Mrs. Dwight Eisenhower of the annual Heart Fund campaign now underway. The importance of the drive is emphasized by the fact that heart disease is now recognized as the nation's number one killer. Dr. White has long had a worldwide reputation in his field. He was graduated from Harvard University, and he served as a teacher there for many years. His book, Heart Disease, is widely used as a medical textbook. Dr. White was one of the founders of the American Heart Association. He has won many awards, including the French Legion of Honor, and degrees from leading universities in all parts of the world. And now seated around the press table, ready to interview Dr. White, are Ray Shearer of NBC News, Marcus Childs of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Earl Ubel of the New York Herald Tribune, and Lawrence E. Spivak, our regular member of the Meet the Press panel. Now, Dr. White, if you're ready, we'll start the questions with Mr. Spivak.
Dr. White, not so long ago, you referred to heart disease as the modern American epidemic. Why do you call it an American epidemic?
Because it's been so much more prominent here in this country than in other parts of the world lately.
Dr. White, I'd like now to get to a subject that I know will interest a great many people. No body has been observed as closely since he had his heart attack as President Eisenhower has by his doctors. Have you doctors learned anything of significance from observing the president during these past few years?
Oh, yes. I think it's been very helpful. As we've learned from him, as we have from thousands of others, that one can do well after recovery from an attack of coronary thrombosis, especially if he follows a program that we think is wise.
If you were to advise the public on the best-known methods of preventing heart disease today, what specifically and briefly would you advise them to do or not to do?
Well, in the first place, I have a ready answer for that, and that is to support the research that's now going on, and so that in the course of the next generation, perhaps in a decade or two, we may have some clear-cut advice. The present moment, we're groping. We have some pretty good ideas.
Do you know anything at all that is sure to prevent a heart attack? Is there anything definite, for example, as vaccination for smallpox?
I suppose you mean by a heart attack, and all kinds of heart attacks.
Yes,
of course,
I mean
the coronary attack.
Yes.
No, we haven't anything that's 100% certain at the present time in the way of prevention. And that's why, chief reason, we need so much money for the research that we're now, after this month, not only from the American, for the American Heart Association, but for the congressional appropriation of money for investigations of the sort.
Have you yourself come to any conclusions about what possibly could prevent a heart attack?
Well, we have many ideas, and they're pretty well based on our experience, I think. One is that heredity plays a role. We can't do much about that yet, but we shall in the future, I think. Otherwise, we have the environmental factors that we're studying with the question of diet, and exercise or lack of it, stress and strain, and other such factors.
Mr. Ubel.
Dr. White, less than a year ago, you joined with some seven other heart specialists in recommending to the American public at least four steps that they might take to reduce their risk of a heart attack. Let me just list them for the audience. One, you said that the public would do well to reduce in weight, generally. You said also that it would be probably the best thing if somehow or other high blood pressure could be controlled by chemicals. You also added that regular exercise was good in reducing the risk of heart attack. And finally, you said that the public or individuals might reduce excessive cigarette smoking. Now, let me take the last one first, and perhaps we'll go through the others in time. With respect to cigarette smoking, I think it's quite clear that most of the major statistical studies have shown that the heart attack rate is twice as high among cigarette smokers as non-smokers. What would you say the public ought to do with respect to cigarette smoking now?
Well, certainly those individuals who are candidates for trouble, and this is one of the important points I want to point out, is that those who are candidates for trouble probably should follow those directions more than the average run of individuals. As I say, we haven't enough proof yet that tobacco per se causes atherosclerosis. But it is true that those who smoke most heavily are more likely to live shorter lives and also to have trouble with their heart. But the direct connection is uncertain.
Going to diet, what should you say that the American public should do about its diet?
I think that's a little clearer from the studies that have been made so far. Wherever there's prosperity, unusual prosperity in any country or any part of any country, we find that there's more atherosclerosis, this rusting of the arteries, which involves not only the coronaries that supply the heart muscle, but the brain too, the arteries going to the brain. And wherever there is this prosperity, there are several factors involved, one of which, and the most prominent right away, is that of diet. Enrichment of the diet, especially high in fat content. So there again, we have some advice, especially for candidates for trouble, which we think is reasonable even before we've 100% proof that this is sure protection.
In other words, cut down on fat. Is that the...
Cut down total calories, too, because we know that obesity is attended by shorter life, whether from vascular disease, cardiovascular disease, or for other reasons we aren't certain. But obesity, as has been proved by the life insurance companies, does shorten life.
And what about people? What about high blood pressure?
That too. It's a question of how high the pressure is. Those with very high pressure certainly need treatment for it in order to cut down the wear and tear on the arteries, and there seems little doubt, but that the higher the pressure, the more likely the arteries are to be involved in this atherosclerosis.
Mr. Childs.
Dr. White, in less than a year now, President Eisenhower will have been retired after having traveled more than any president in history. He said the other day that he thought of just going and sitting in a rocking chair. What would you prescribe for heart patients who have been active, recovered, and are active, and then have to retire?
Well, we advised against his sitting in a rocking chair 4 or 5 years ago. And I don't think that he needs to sit in the rocking chair now. I think it would be better for his health if he didn't, actually.
You think he should continue to lead a pretty active life?
Oh, I think activity, both physical and mental, within reason, is important for health at any age. And I think it's helpful for longevity, actually. Well, many retire long before they should.
Someone has suggested he might run for vice president. Do you think that would come under the category of activity, Dr. White?
I think he could be even more useful than that.
That time you were just speaking of now, when you made some very important decisions, did you feel under any outside pressures then, Dr. White, of one kind or another?
No, there are inside pressures due to lack of adequate follow-up study at the time. We wanted this to be scientifically based, this decision, and we were able to, through the follow-up of individuals whom we'd studied for 20, 25, 30 years. And we finally finished that follow-up study, and it was very helpful in the decision.
Well, I was thinking of the fact that the record showed that I think it was about September 30, you said you thought that perhaps the strain would be too great on the president if he ran again. And then a little later, you came around to rather another view.
Oh, no, that wasn't quite...
Wasn't that correct?
...the situation. I was asked, if I were the president, would I run? And I said, I wouldn't want that job. I'd seen enough of it to know that it was a strenuous job that wouldn't please me. But that was a personal situation, but it was misinterpreted.
And you don't think that if he had decided against running, he would be in better health today than he is, Dr. Wine?
Oh, no. I'm sure he needed the kind of activity that he's had, especially lately, I think.
You think this, I followed him around on that 11-nation tour, you think that kind of thing is very good for him, do you?
Well, it's work that he is just fit, especially adapted to. He likes it. It's an important function. And he's followed the rules otherwise, so far as his health's concerned, with respect to diet and exercise and so forth.
Mr. Shearer.
What are these rules, Doctor? What special diet is the president on, and is he still taking the dicumeril that I think
yes.
you prescribed?
But the anticoagulant, it's important, I'm sure, but it isn't the whole story. I believe that many persons, after their first heart attack, are better protected if they follow these general directions than they were before they had their first heart attack. The one rule is that the weight should be an optimal weight, and if there's an overweight, it should be reduced until we get back to the fighting weight, and he went back to his West Point weight. And another is that of the diet, which is not only should be low enough in calories to keep the weight down, but we believe that it should be relatively low in fat, especially animal fat. That's the general experience today, and we say 25 to 30% of the total calories shouldn't be over that. The fat shouldn't be more than that. At the present time, it tends to be 40 to 50% in the average American diet. And then exercise is important, not just physiologically, and perhaps as a retarding factor in the development of this rusting of the arteries, but as an antidote for nervous tension. Many people don't realize that. If any of you can remember the days when you got physically tired and the pleasant sensation you had, and the restful feeling, I can recommend that you resume such activity, and you will find it very helpful. And then the anticoagulant was the fourth point.
On this matter of exercise, isn't it a fact that, from your point of view, the president has been almost a model patient? His recovery and the fact that he does play golf and hunt, has that given zest to a lot of heart patients and, in effect, made your work easier?
Oh, yes, because we'd been doing it for years before that. As I said to somebody the other day, that after all, he's just a run-of-the-mill case. That is, we'd had experience with this kind of problem before, and we had realized that those who hadn't been in the custom of getting a benefit of a program of positive health, not just the absence of disease, but a program of positive health, would benefit by it.
On February 29th, 1956, which was a couple of months after the heart attack, the president made a speech about his health in which he said that he would have to do less. He couldn't barnstorm around the country, I remember him saying. And now, in effect, he's barnstorming around the world. Isn't he doing more than even you would have thought for
him? Well, this was when he was convalescent, not fully rehabilitated. Perhaps rehabilitated so far as his heart was concerned, but it takes a few months, usually, to get back into one's stride. And so one advises, generally, going a little easy at first and then going full blast later, if all goes well.
Mr. Spivak.
Dr. White, you've been quoted as saying in the past that the strain of the presidency is well-nigh intolerable, both physically and mentally. I think those were the words New York Times said you said. Yet now you seem to put much less stress on the question of stress and strain. Why? How do you explain that?
Well, in the first place, something good came of that remark. A lot of the unnecessary labor was removed from the president's back. Of course, also, we felt that, I felt personally about this. It would be an intolerable strain for me, I think, but for some it wouldn't be, and I think it's quite evident that it isn't an intolerable strain for the president.
Well, now, do you or do you not think that stress and strain, the kind of society we live in now, does contribute? I'm not talking about food. I'm simply talking about high-pressure living and high-pressure individuals. Do you think this does or does not contribute to heart disease?
We don't know. That's one of the reasons we need more research in this field of epidemiology, as we call it, the causes of disease, from the standpoint of all the environmental factors, which would include stress and strain, just as in the case of the need of the study of heredity, the background, the host himself. It is quite clear, I think, that there are many factors. We can't feel that any one factor is preeminent at the present time. Stress and strain can certainly, whether physical or emotional, can precipitate trouble. But usually, as Lancisi said in this book I have here on sudden death, 252 years ago, there's already a background, a basis of disease on which, on top of which comes this sudden death or heart attack. In other words, he recognized as long ago as that a disease of the arteries was a long continued disease and that stress might precipitate the final result. But it doesn't, it probably, we aren't sure that it causes the original disease, although there's some evidence accumulating that it may be a factor.
Well, and yet this is the most stressful job, I guess, in the world, and yet you didn't hesitate to recommend that the president, in spite of the heart attack, continue it. So you must think that stress and strain plays very little part.
Well, we think it depends on the individual and what he's used to. Just as when we rehabilitate patients now, we don't necessarily, after an attack, we don't have them take lighter jobs. Sometimes a lighter job, what seems to us a lighter job, is harder for the individual to do, even though physically it doesn't seem so much.
Doctor,
as the old job.
I'd like to ask you one question about the American Heart Association, which has collected, I believe, in the last 10 years, something like $130 million from the public. And now I think hoping to get $25 million or so again.
26.
Yes. Now, what has the association accomplished during the last 10 years that should make the public willing to hand over once again so many millions of dollars? Has there been anything specific? Has there been anything important?
From the time I was first treasurer in 1924, when it was established, until about 1946, it was a relatively quiet, professional organization with its annual meeting and its journal. And then it realized, I mean, the members, directors of the association realized that there was this tremendous challenge of public health. And the decision was made to enter the public health field with private initiative and private support. This was even before the Public Health Service had started the National Heart Institute. And so in 1946, they went out for one of their first drives, or 48, I think it was, and they had a few thousand dollars, and they've gradually increased this from the standpoint of research, as well as their program, as well as training and education and community projects. They've increased now so that it's doing a very large amount of research and training for research in the field, although they still have a large part of their funds for education and community projects.
Well, is there anything specific that you can point to that they have done with all this money in the last 10 years? Have they made any outstanding contributions?
Yes, of course, tremendous advances have been made by various groups, by the Public Health Service, too. In the field, for example, of the infectious diseases, we now have very relatively little infectious heart disease, which would include really rheumatic heart disease. It comes from hemolytic streptococcus. Syphilitic heart disease is practically out. diphtheria and other causes of heart disease of the infectious nature now are past history, almost. But cardiovascular surgery has been tremendous. But we have these tremendous problems still waiting for us.
Mr. Ubel.
As long as we're talking about money, last year the National Heart Institute got $62 million. This year, I notice in the president's budget message, it's been raised to $63 million. Do you think this is a sufficient raise to take care of the many projects which
We think not. We think not because in the natural development of the program, where the year before it had been $45 million, then $62 million, there's this constant growth of training as well as of research projects and more concentration on certain particular aspects like hypertension and this atherosclerosis, wherever it occurs in the country. And now there's also need of the development of a monkey colony, which we lack in this country, a serious lack for some of the research that's going on. And in the international field, we must have more development.
So you think the $63 million budget recommendation is inadequate?
It's too small.
How much do you think it should be?
Well, the Citizens Committee here, which has involved a good many New York people, has asked for a little over $100 million. And this is interesting because when we started in 1948, we had a National Advisory Heart Council. And half the group were doctors and six laymen. And one of the doctors, very economically, suggested that $50 was too much on one application for some test tubes. And one of the laymen rose and he said, "Gentlemen, I thought you believed in this program. You've got to spend millions, not hundreds." And he set a goal then in 1948 of $100 million. And here we are. It's been growing steadily. And now we all agree with him, but it wouldn't have been possible at that time to have grown so rapidly.
Mr. Childs.
Dr. White, among the candidates for president this year, one candidate has had a heart attack, another has had a serious kidney ailment, one has suffered serious injuries in the war, another has had the sympathectomy operation. I wonder if you could conceive of an official or semi-official medical board that would pass on these men.
Well,
would that be useful?
I don't think so. I don't think it's necessary. I think the doctors nowadays, alerted as they are, in their advice to the individual as well as with the country in mind, the welfare of the country, can give advice adequately. Many of these illnesses can be not only survived, but supported for many years, even though they're chronic. For example, the president has a scar in his heart. It does him no harm to have that scar in his heart. Others who used to have trouble now are better or are tolerating. And, of course, some of the most important work in the world in the past has been done by people who were thought to be cripples.
Well, taking this one step further, we've had in this century three presidents who have had serious illnesses in the White House. What if a situation came up in which a president, while he was incapacitated and his doctor told him so, felt that he could continue in the office? Do you think his physician would have a personal obligation to tell the public that this man was incapacitated?
Perhaps I ought to have Jim Haggerty here to answer the question.
Well, you do very well without him, don't you?
Well, I think that, of course, one of the reasons the vice president is at hand is to take over if necessary. And that's been spelled out in this last...
But you know very well, Dr. White, that many people still believe that President Roosevelt was too ill to go to Yalta. Do you think a doctor could have spoken at that time about his condition?
Well, times have changed.
Mr. Shearer.
Doctor, I'm intrigued with your point that heart disease is a kind of a problem of prosperity. The fact that it's an American thing, that our standard of living is perhaps too soft. A lot of people are concerned about that anyway. Now, how do you get at a problem like that? Does everybody start riding bicycles, or what would you have us do?
Well, I think we ought to continue to be prosperous, but to keep prosperity under control, not to let it be our masters, but our slaves. There's no reason why we should be unhealthy simply because we're prosperous, and we've become one of the unhealthiest countries in the world with respect to this atherosclerosis. It's just almost as bad as undernutrition and starvation, but it's the other extreme. In other words, one type of malnutrition is overnutrition, and we're just beginning to recognize that.
What would you recommend to the average man to bring this down, the average man, to ward off heart disease?
Well, I think he ought to start in the early 20s and not gain a pound after he's 25 or even 24 or 23, especially if he comes of a family that has had similar trouble. Also, he should maintain vigorous physical exercise all through life, especially if he's very muscular, because we are born to use our muscles. There must be, and we know there's a beneficial effect not only on the circulation, but on the digestion and on the nerves. You know, the peripatetic philosophers, or rather the Stoic philosophers, used to walk along the Stoa when they philosophized. I think they realized that with good use of their leg muscles, they had better circulation than
brain. Doctor, we're all grateful for this medical advice, but I'm sorry I'm going to have to interrupt. I see their time is up. Monitor's thanks to Dr. Paul Dudley White